I'm Paul Menzel. The topic today is doctors' incomes. When is enough enough? I put it as a question, not a statement, as announced this morning. Because it still, in some ways, is a question when I get done with the discussion. What I'd like to do today is give a fairly compact run-through of my analysis of the problem. Ask clarification questions along the way, but try to hold the bigger argumentative and justification questions until the end. I think just given the nature of some of what I'm going to say, it's better if I run through it. But do ask clarification questions as I go along. Pardon me if I'm shuffling papers a time or two. Some of this is written out, and I'm a little less conversant in it than in the other topics, so I'm relying on some writing points. There's a quotation from George Bernard Shaw in his play The Doctor's Dilemma, which is often quoted. George Bernard Shaw wrote, "Any sane nation, having observed that you could provide for the supply of bread by giving bakers a pecuniary interest in baking for you, should go on to give a surgeon a pecuniary interest in cutting off your leg is enough to make one despair of political humanity." Another critic of the level of physicians' incomes writes the following, more current critic: "If the return to health is the principal concern of the patient who is well, the fee becomes his or her principal concern after he or she is well. Our critics will acknowledge our long hours, sympathize," he himself is a doctor, this writer, "sympathize with the tension of life and death decision making, and yet, in the end, scorn our affluence." And I think, affluence it is. The current estimate is, though, for 1980, though the figures aren't yet out in print, is that the average physician's income in the United States in 1980 was $81,000. Now that includes everything. So if you're going to compare it with another occupation, you have to include the other occupation's fringe benefits, because a lot of the data collected is from private physicians who don't have somebody else providing the fringe benefits. We might say that the power over societal resources that healthcare institutions in general have is directly reflected in the economic status and economic power of physicians. But then on the other hand, you get a viewpoint like that expressed long ago by Adam Smith, who wrote, "We trust our health to the physician, our fortune and sometimes our life and reputation to the lawyer. Such confidence could not safely be reposed in people of a very mean or a very low condition. Their reward must be such as may give them rank in the society which so important a trust requires." That was from The Wealth of Nations, Smith's greatest work. Some facts do appear, on the surface at least, to bear Smith out. One rather striking fact is that with all their variations in healthcare delivery, Canada, France, Germany, Britain, and the United States, and there's quite a lot of difference in the healthcare delivery structures in those countries. In all those countries, the ratio of physicians' income to average full-time employed persons' income varies only from 4.72 to 6.52. In all those countries, it's very close to 5. And 4.72 is the United States, and 6.52 is Germany, which has a lot more governmental control over medicine, for example, than in the United States. And Britain, which has even more governmental control, in which most doctors are salaried by the National Health Service, has a higher ratio of physicians' income to average full-time employed persons' income than the United States has. It's only 4.72 in the United States, but it's 5-point-something in Britain. One interpretation of those figures is that somehow people need to know that their physicians are paid roughly 5 times what they on the average are paid. Otherwise, they don't feel right about going to a doctor. And, for example, since health clearly is more important than reputation, isn't it? It's not at all surprising that it's more essential than a reputation for our well-being. It's not surprising at all that physicians are paid 5 times the average person's income, and lawyers are paid only 2.5 times, or 2 times the average person's income. And it's not surprising that a society would do that. But yet, I think there are still some very major questions. If healthcare costs have run out of control, partly because we have mistakenly thought that life and life saving and risk reduction has no price, aren't doctors' earnings questionable? Who gets paid what for a resource is as crucial an allocation question as how much of what is used and for whom that is used. Those are all allocation questions. And who gets paid is as much what is as much an allocation question as the others. So the question, is healthcare worth the money we pay for it, inevitably gets us to a discussion of physicians' incomes. Now, this discussion has amazingly, maybe it's not amazing politically, but academically it seems to be amazing, has been ignored in the literature. If you look for articles in the academic journals or anywhere on the justification of physicians' incomes, not just the description of what they are, and not just some narrow economic analysis of, okay, do physicians restrict the competing supply of entering physicians? And if you really get to try to look for articles that size up the situation, now, are physicians' incomes at their present level justified? I found 2. Believe it or not, 2. And that's with National Library of Medicine computer searches and every available library resource I get my hands on. There were narrow ones. I'm using some standards to weed out others. But if you really get to the comprehensive ones about justification, I found only 2. Fuchs himself, in the book Who Shall Live, says, we needn't bother with discussing the level of physicians' income, because if you cut physicians' incomes 20%, you would cut the total healthcare budget only 3%. Because physicians' incomes are only 12% of the healthcare budget, physicians' gross incomes are only 20% of the healthcare budget, even though physicians control a very large portion of healthcare expenditures, because they prescribe who goes into hospitals, gets drugs, etc. If you cut their net incomes 20%, you'd only cut the budget 3%, the total budget spent on healthcare 3%. So a lot of economists have said it's not worth worrying about. Well, it seems to me that that's a mistake, because at the same time you get all kinds of economists and medical people worrying about whether or not a particular procedure that's now been developed should be adopted, and they figure out how much it's going to cost per life saved, and they say maybe it shouldn't be adopted, and that maybe is only 0.1% of the total national health care budget. So they worry about all kinds of smaller things than the 3% of all physicians' incomes. And besides, why should we necessarily stick with a 20% reduction, a lot of people will say, when we're starting with an $81,000 base? Why shouldn't we think of a 50% reduction? Then we're up to a 6% reduction, which on a $220 billion national health care budget is still something like $7 billion. And $7 billion is a lot more of an individual cut in health care costs than anything else that's been recommended, any other specific thing that's been recommended in the by the people very concerned about costs. So I think we just have to ask the question, are doctors worth what we pay them? And is what we pay them fair and just compared to what other people have paid? Let's look at some facts here. First of all, some historical facts. Doctors' incomes were $4,000 in 1940, $12,000 in 1950, $42,000 in 24,000 in 1960, if we go in 10-year increments, $42,000 in 1970, and $81,000 in 1980. They more than doubled between 1940 and 1950, and they've just about doubled in non-discounted for inflation terms since then. If you discount for inflation, their real incomes have still increased. Only in the 1970s, when other people too were seeing their increases eaten away by inflation, did physicians not gain in real income. There were substantial gains in real income in the earlier decades. In the 1970s, however, physicians experienced a 0.1% drop in real income in the 1970s. So they have not gone up since 1970 in real terms. But other people's have, on the average, have dropped some. So still, relative to other occupations, they've gained a bit. In 1940, physicians' incomes were twice as great as the national average full-time employed person's income. In 1980, they are 4.5 to 5 times as great. So relative to other occupations, between 1940 and 1980, physicians have gained considerably. If we look at comparisons of other professions, I'm not able to get 1980 statistics here because of the statistics the Bureau of Labor puts out in its handbook are from their 1980 volume, and their 1980 volume deals with 1978 statistics. They're a year behind in publishing it and a year and a half behind in gathering it then. So I have to deal with 1978 figures in which the average physician's income is $71,000, not $81,000. You can see that between 1978 and 1980, physicians have dropped in real income. They've only gone up to 81, and inflation has been a higher rate than that. And I put out here the ratio of that figure to a $15,000 base. $15,000 in 1978 was the average full-time employee's income, or worker's income. Physicians, $71,000, 4.7 ratio to the $15,000 average income base. Airline pilots, $57,000, 3.8. Dentists, $50,000, 3.3. Lawyers, $31,000, 2.1. Veterinarians, $30,000, 2.0. Air traffic controllers, then, $25,500, 1.7. Architects, $25,000, 1.7. Professors, $22,400. And that is raised for the 9-month academic year. It's about $18,000 for the 9-month academic year, and I've added 20% to that for, not 30%, I don't think that's fair. I think it's not really a 3-month vacation professors get. To get 22.5, which is 1.5, nurses 16.8 to 1.1, and firefighters right at the national average. These are professions, most of the, they either involve long training or some risk, or high prestige in society, otherwise not just in economic terms, etc. Now, the first thing to notice about this is that if you discount for hours, there are disputes about what the average number of hours a physician works. One of the major surveys, the one done by Medical Economics each year, has in the late 70s estimated the number of hours to be 62 per week on the average for a physician. Other studies claim that that's inflated, and I think probably a better guess is 50 per week. But using 50 per week and counting the excess between 40 and 50 at time and a half, which is only fair, that $81,000 1980 income is only $52,000. So that, for example, if you discount for excess hours, airline pilots are higher paid than physicians on the air. They don't work more than 40 a week. They work less. And dentists don't work as many hours as doctors. If you discount for hours, this figure drops considerably. So it... relative to these other occupations, physicians are not really paid more. On the average.
Are those incomes including the value of the fringe benefits?
Yes. All of these include the value of the fringe benefits. This may look low, but that, remember, it's 1978. So we're 3 years behind. Now, specialties. Orthopedists have usually been the highest on the average if we take a specialty group. And in 1970, 7. It's hard to get the same calculations for the same year on all these things. You can't find it in the literature. I mean, 1977, so remember this would be about 66,000 then. 1977, two of every orthopedists made more than $100,000 a year. In 1977, pathologists and radiologists were a little behind orthopedists on the average, but hospital-based pathologists and hospital-based radiologists who had percentage of gross department, pathology department or radiology department, revenue contracts for generating their salary, had respectively average $160,000 and $145,000 incomes. That's 1977. That would be up way over 200 now.
Does that include their private practice too, besides the hospital situation?
No. These would be pathologists and radiologists working in a hospital. Their business would be in a hospital. They would have a contract.
A whole clinic of 14. And they were, the one is in charge of the whole nuclear medicine division, but he also has a private office across the street. There's a lot of work as well.
I don't know. This statistic didn't clarify whether that income included. I think it just included what's gotten from the hospital. Now, still, pathologists and radiologists on the average don't come out as high as orthopedists, because not that many pathologists and radiologists have this gross percentage of gross department revenue contract with the hospital. Now, some people have surmised that one of the major reasons why average physicians' incomes, at least relative to other occupations in society, have gone up considerably from 1940 to 1980 is that specialties have grown. But the statistics definitely refute that claim. The average family practitioner's income and primary care practitioners, if you take internists, pediatricians, and general practitioners are now family practitioners. If you take those three groups and look at the increase in their incomes between 1940 and 1980, it's exactly the same increase, percentage-wise, as physicians in general. So that specialists and primary care physicians have increased at the same rate. And therefore, the reason for the increase from a 2.0 ratio to the average national income in 1940 to 4.7 now cannot be that there are a lot more specialists, because the specialists haven't gone up anymore. Dave?
I need to follow that point, because when family physicians, internists, and pediatricians, all these specialists, they all require a residency.
Well, they're specialists in a sense, but
it's an extra training that you would have.
You don't want to stick with the designation general GP, general practitioner, and currently it's more relevant to include family practitioners, internists, and pediatricians in that. They're called primary care physicians.
Yeah, but they're all specialists in terms of training, extra training.
Okay. Okay, that's right, and maybe to defray the cost of training, the extra cost of training compared to a GP, that's incomes have gone up. Yes. Yeah, I hadn't thought of that. That may account for some of it. But that's not mentioned in the literature as possible, as the reason why some people claim that the specialists, this is the increased emphasis on specialties is a part of the explanation. Okay. Now, what I want to do today is look at two questions. First of all, the possible causes of the high level of income. And one of those will involve some further discounting, like the hours, but of a different sort. And we'll change our final estimates here considerably. And then finally, I want to get to the question of the moral justification. I should mention at the beginning some alternate salary systems. Fee-for-service is predominant in the United States. A physician does not have a salary. A physician just takes in money, defrays costs, takes in money on the basis of being paid a particular fee for a particular service delivered. Another payment model or method is capitation, where you pay a physician by the number of patients on his or her rolls. British National Health Service does that, by and large, for at least primary care physicians. And a third method, common method, is salary. You find very little use of capitation in the United States. You find some use of salary, and you find a lot of use of fee-for-service. Now, many people think, as George Bernard Shaw's quote indicates, that fee-for-service is the culprit here. Anybody who thinks that just because you give bakers a pecuniary interest in baking bread, and goes, any society that then goes on to give physicians, surgeons a pecuniary interest in cutting off your leg is ought to have its head examined. Well, I don't think it's that simple. All these three payment mechanisms, fee-for-service, capitation, salary, have their advantages and disadvantages. The disadvantage of fee-for-service is that you get some over-doctoring, marginally or unnecessary or unnecessary care. You get kind of a certain rushed delivery, and perhaps you get a focusing on increasing your income in the physician's minds. The disadvantage of capitation, though it overcomes some of those, not all of them though, certainly, is that you get under-doctoring. You just want to increase the number of patients on your rolls. And so you don't want to spend that much time with each one of them, or deliver that as many services to each one of them, which may, in certain cases, be necessary. And that is, in fact, the criticism of physicians in Britain, is that they under-doctor people. The criticism here is that they over-doctor people. You also, in capitation systems, get a focus on healthy patients. Physicians go out to get healthy patients. Now, that's terrible in a healthcare system. You don't get that in fee-for-service at all. With salary, you might think, well, you don't get over-doctoring, you don't get under-doctoring. So what are the possible disadvantages of salary? Maybe that's the panacea here. Well, there's some disadvantages there, too. First of all, there are not many incentives to be efficient. Not as many as when you're working either under capitation or fee-for-service. Second, so you then have to build in other incentives to be efficient, like you have to be overseen and supervised. Well, you know, how do you do that? That can get into a lot of inefficiency, too. And furthermore, probably the most important disadvantage of salary, which is usually overlooked, is that physicians then become oriented toward the person paying their salary instead of oriented toward the patient. That's the way to get ahead. Do what the payer wants. But the payer isn't, in any sense, the patient. I don't think any particular method of payment is a panacea, nor is any particular method of payment a culprit, if we think physicians' incomes are too high. Well, then, let me get back to the discussion of the causes of the present level of physicians' income. The first suggestion in the literature on this is occupational investment. It's also called human capital theory, but I don't want to confuse that with the different human capital theory about the price of life that I mentioned on Monday, so I'll call it occupational investment. You not only have to adjust for hours presently worked, says this explanation, you also have to adjust for the expenses of schooling. And more importantly, not just for what people paid for their schooling, but for the deferred income during their low-paid schooling years. And you have to add to that interest on that deferred amount. And by the time you do all that, this, if you just count for hours presently worked, the 4.7 drops to 3.5. And if you discount for expenses of schooling and deferred income involved, including a discount for interest on that, this comes out 2.1. 2.1. No, excuse me, that's wrong. It comes out 2.6 or so. And then, if you compare it to other people who've had higher education, college graduate and beyond, bachelor's degree and beyond, the ratio of physicians' incomes to average college graduates' income is only 2.1, something like that. So it drops a lot. Now, that is the conservative estimate. There are some economists who've argued with somewhat different figures that after accounting for the current higher hours that physicians work and accounting for the expenses and deferred income of schooling years, that physicians are paid exactly the average of college graduates. I think, however, they've gone wrong because they've used a 60-hour per work week now. And I think the more accurate estimate, it's very crucial in the computations, is a 50-hour work week for physicians. And it makes all the difference in the world. If you use a 60-hour work week, which some questionnaires show up, the question is, are the questionnaires good? You get the conclusion that physicians are paid no more than the average college graduate. On the average, physicians are paid no more than the average college graduate. Early?
Just that on the one side, my neurosurgeon said that he normally planned on working 50 to 20 years because his hands would begin to shake. He's very limited ministry. Many of them are adequate, they go into teaching. On the other hand, I know a person who's a radiologist, whom I'm sure makes about 160,000, but the intriguing thing is that he has two planes that are on rent and a condominium set. And I once was given the AMA Medical Journal and the Medical Economics Journal. The economics book or magazine was larger than the medical book, and it told all the techniques by specialists as to how to invest. And I presume that's maybe where those who get large sums in a certain period of time can discover ways of reinvesting. In LA, there are lawyers galore who are very astute. I know men making $225,000, $75,000, $85,000, pay no tax at all. And two men that I know that I used to read about, hear about in North Hollywood, from tax purses, had at that time only about $120 million each. They paid no tax.
Okay, I'd rather keep the tax discussion out of this because that's a question that affects everybody, not just physicians. And I'd rather focus on things. Yeah.
Okay.
Now, to be sure, this...
Paul?
Yes?
Haven't you figured, though, the loss of income on other... I mean, I went 10 years college student, all outgo, no income. Haven't you figured that in?
PhDs come out under the average.
Okay, it makes me feel
PhDs good. Come out under the average. And so relative to PhDs, physicians, even by this particular author's... Not mine, this one author that argued the average, after you do all the discounting, okay, of physicians' income, given the return on investment in schooling, is exactly equal to physicians' income.
Okay.
But my contention is that's not correct. And this is just from reading literature, not doing any independent studies myself, just reading literature. It seems that those authors who claim it's equal have made a mistake in the hours calculation, and therefore we should regard physicians' average income as a little more than twice the average full-time employed person's income after discounting for investment in schooling and current hours worked, and less than two, definitely less than two, something like 1.5 times the average college graduate's income.
Why do you dispute those hours, the hours worked?
Because other studies show that physicians are working 45 hours a week on the average. It's a question of who got the questionnaire. Is a medical that came out with a 62-hour figure is a medical economics magazine questionnaire. It goes, who responds to that? Probably physicians in private practice who are working high numbers of hours. So you don't get an accurate average.
Okay.
And yet the figure we're dealing with for the 71 or 1980 terms, $81,000 is an average figure, so we ought to get an average. The other thing was the questionnaire itself, repeatedly used by Medical Economics Magazine, says, well, how many hours did you work in your last full week? But that doesn't necessarily generate an average hour, a weekly figure for the year. Yes?
The average hours worked, I would say you'd probably see a variation between specialists and general practitioners.
Great.
So if you're not comparing apples to apples, I think.
Right. I'm taking an average. I'm dealing with the average. Yes?
How many years in education is there a difference between a nurse and a physician? How many years of a college education?
A nurse, let us figure at 5 years, 1 year beyond college. Some would claim four, but I think it's better to put it in at five, because most of them have to go an extra summer or two. They can't do it. Four. Let's figure it at five. For physician is automatically eight, plus internship, plus residency. So we're talking about 12.
They
don't have to, but for, it's increasingly common. It's increasingly common. Okay, but if we're talking about averages again, I think the average is going to come out something like 10 or 11 years instead of five for a nurse.
But so the nurse really must come out below the,
right.
Even with 5 years, she must come out below the national average.
Now, I'm not saying that interns and residents are paid nothing. It's not like students where they're not getting any income. But their incomes are very low. Even in 1981, a big dispute at the University of Washington among the residents had take-home income. This is after taxes. Take-home income of a little less than $800 a month for first-year residents. So it's not high at all. Okay, so I would conclude that if you discount for occupational investment, this figure drops quite a bit. But it is, what it comes out as, if you do the same discounting for lawyers, doctors and lawyers turn out to be the same after discounting for the higher occupational investment time of physicians and the higher number of hours worked. By the way, lawyers don't end up with a higher than 40 figure for average hours presently worked. And professors, the studies come out, disturbing to me in terms of the averages. I would say, oh, I'm up around 55, something like that. Come up 38. That's what the two studies I've seen on professors average. Come up 38 hours per week work to get their salary, to get the salary they get from their institution. They may do other things on the side, other consulting. Well, I'm just saying, a lot of professors at PLU, for example, if you ask them how much they worked a week, you told them physicians got work 50 hours a week, and then you said, well, you got a discount for that overtime. I'd say, yeah, I got to discount my 22 and a half down here for overtime, too. Boy, do. But in fact, on the average, you don't. You shouldn't be discounted.
Well, I don't think 38 hours is accurate. I've never spent that few hours in my job in my life.
That's what the studies show about professors across the nation on the average. I don't know. Again, I haven't looked into
that. My game, I have to study constantly just to stay up.
So do the physicians.
Well, they're including that, though. The
no, they're not, they're not talking counting study time. Well, at any rate, occupational investment is one theory to explain the higher incomes, and it says after the discounting, there is either certainly less of this level drops and becomes either equal to lawyers. That's what I would claim. It's equal to lawyers. It's still higher, about twice as high as the average full-time employee's income, and 50% higher than the average college graduate, both for lawyers and physicians. Instead of saying, like a couple of authors, they're in the minority, who say that it really comes out equal. So, we're not talking about, we shouldn't think $81,000. If the average income is now 15 and the average college graduate's is 22 now, we shouldn't think 81 as physicians' incomes. We should think 32, something like that. 35. That's what we should think. Yes?
Are you figuring medical practice insurance?
Net income. No, net 81 is net, or for 1980, or 71 for 1978 is net income.
Paul, does that take into account the discretionary income they have when they are earning this higher income, the reinvestment on through their career? Well,
does not
then you have to kind of build it back up again, that factor.
Well, if somebody did earn income fairly, I'm not saying they did, we have to get to that question. If they did earn it fairly, then if they get returns on from investing that, why should you take that away?
Well, because
it's part of their compensation for their earning this in their career, and it's part of their total compensation because these other people would not have that opportunity.
Well, but they didn't. Not everybody chooses to invest it. You're right. Well, it's a complicated issue. Other people don't have the opportunity to invest.
Right.
You're right. You're right. It's a mixed bag. Okay, let's go on to some other explanations. Another explanation of the high incomes is everybody agrees occupational investment is part of the explanation, and you have to discount somewhat for that, and the question is how much. A further explanation for what is still the excess, the higher positions, although we'd have to ask the same question about lawyers, because they'd now be about equal after accounting for occupational investment and ours. One explanation of the remaining excess compared to either average college graduates or average full-time employees' income is the monopoly control that physicians have. And in particular, it is claimed by some that physicians over the last 40 years have restricted supply. Now, the question at issue there is, well, just to back up and explain the theory, if they restrict supply of physicians, then people who need physicians are going to have a harder time finding one, and they'll bid up the price, and so naturally you're going to have a salary level higher than just a normal return on their occupational investment. And since medical schools can control the supply of physicians, it is claimed that without any necessarily conscious conspiracy and coordination here, medical schools have kept the supply down. They've done that partly out of quality reasons, but it's played right into the hands of physicians and given them a kind of monopoly control. Now, the question at issue here is, what is the optimal number of doctors? What would be a shortage? How do you determine that the present number of doctors is a shortage, such that you can then claim that physicians have restricted the supply? The authors who claim that after discounting for occupational investment, the return on occupational investment is normal, a doctor isn't higher than other educated people's, that they claim that the optimal number of physicians is just whatever number of physicians there are, which in competition with each other generate an income level which is the average normal return on schooling, on training. And since some economists claim the return of physicians on their schooling comes out to make their salaries really equal to others, those economists say there's no shortage of physicians. It seems to me that there's a definitive piece of evidence, however. First of all, I would say there is a higher than normal return on occupational investment in being a doctor. But furthermore, there's a particular piece of evidence. Foreign medical graduates have been hired by the droves in the last 30 years in the United States. For example, the number of positions for interns and residents rose from 21,000 in 1950 to 56,000 in 1973, while the percentage of those positions filled by foreign medical school graduates rose from 9.6% of the 21,000 positions in 1950 to 32.7% of the 56,000 positions in 1973. Why did we have to go to foreign medical graduates to fill the interns and the internship and residency positions? If there wasn't a shortage of people being produced by American medical schools, we wouldn't have had that movement, presumably.
How many of those are American students, so they have to go out of the country because they can't get into the medical schools here in the country?
The question still is why American society should, two questions, why American society should be taking people trained in another system with different standards, perhaps, and different training philosophies. And furthermore, the more important question is why should we arrange things in the international order such that whatever other country you're talking about, their medical school investments get put into an American person who then comes back to the United States instead of practicing in their own country, which in the developing countries is a very, very serious problem.
What's the reason to create an internship or a residency?
Okay, we'd have to ask that question. Maybe there are too many of those, so there really isn't the shortage of position if we got rid of the unnecessary residencies and internships. But the general tone of discussion seems to be that maybe there are too few internships. But that's, you're right, that's a very legitimate question. So I would conclude that there is at least some prima facie evidence for saying that there has been a shortage, and that that is one of the what has created the extra power and leverage of physicians by which they could get incomes higher than a normal return on their investment in education. There's a third explanation of the higher income here. Well, suppose that you got rid of the shortage, so you had an optimal number of positions. What would then happen to incomes? Would they drop? Would physicians' incomes drop? The evidence is that they wouldn't. The evidence is that, though it's only microscopic evidence or microeconomics evidence, it's not, it hasn't been done in any kind of nationwide or larger regional study. It's been done on smaller local scales. If you move from two neurosurgeons, for example, in a metropolitan area with 800,000 people, in general, it's estimated that one neurosurgeon is adequate for 400,000 people. If you move from two neurosurgeons in that 800,000 community to five neurosurgeons in that 800,000 community, what happens to incomes of those of the neurosurgeons? They don't drop at all. What happens is fees go up. To some extent, the number of neurosurgeries goes up, but that doesn't go up all that much. What makes up the difference more is that the fees go up. And since most insurance companies now pay by the formula usual, customary, and reasonable fee, that's the formula, physicians in an area, neurosurgeons in that area, can raise their fees and get reimbursed for them. Now, the reason we've gotten into the usual, customary, and reasonable formula in insurance reimbursement is, I think, ultimately us. The reason insurance companies got into this was they wanted to have the best talking points with potential subscribers.
And one of the talking points is, we assure you that no matter what position you go to, we're going to cover to see at that position's level. So you can go to a very good position instead of you may charge higher than somebody else. So it was the competition of insurance companies for subscribers that created the formula usual, customary, and reasonable fees. And that in turn has allowed physicians to create their own demand and target their income, no matter what the supply, or possible oversupply physicians in the area. My inclination at that point is both to look hard at the whole structure of the insurance business, and it's also to know our own role in that. To some extent, we've met the enemy and the enemy is us. We want it. It's guarantee it. What we originally went to, the maximum percentage of the fees would be covered. And that created the system by which it would be part of the picture for understanding why the vision can target their income. Now, after all this, what do we say about justification? Well, I think there are two ways to go here. One way to go is to say that we should regard a justified income as what income would result from a free market of informed autonomous consumers bidding for the services of suppliers, in the case physicians, who do not prevent, cannot prevent, competing qualified suppliers from entering the market, entering the profession. If that is our standard for a just income, and I'll go on explaining in a minute why I think there's some truth regarding that formula as if it was standard, but it's not the whole truth. Then what we would do to assess a justified level of physician's income is look at the present income, discount for the occupational investment and the higher hours. Then suppose you come up with $32,000, $35,000. And then in turn, discount for the extra monopoly power that physicians have, which gives them a higher than average return on occupational investment, et cetera. And maybe you would then say a fair income would be $25,000, $10,000 anyway, right? But the surprising thing to me is after all those adjustments, you only come out with about a $10,000 to $20,000. $15,000 adjustment. You don't come out knocking the rating down to 40 if you work in that way. Now, another strategy is to say, well, there is some independent criterion of a just income. But wait, it's not what an ideally free market would determine. Now, there are some very good reasons for being suspicious about using an ideally free market criterion. But there are also some defense reasons for thinking that it's on the right track. The most important reason for thinking it's appropriate to consider what would come out of a perfectly free market, even if we're primarily interested in the question of a moral justification or an income one, is the whole business of relative burdens and benefits. One standard, which is very intuitively appealing for establishing a just income, is to say, an income level should be whatever is necessary to make the overall advantages compared to the overall burdens of a particular occupation equal to the relationship of the overall advantages and overall burdens of other occupations. So if one occupation is more burdensome, it should get paid high to keep its ratio of compensation to burden equal to the ratio of compensation to burden in other occupations. And that burden, of course, the burdens are not just the extra hours that can be tallied and computed. It's a tangible thing. The burdens are also stress, strain, attractiveness, the rewards, the compensation is not just monetary, they're prestige, whole lot of things. Now, how would we assess how great some of those intangible compensations are and how great some of those intangible burdens are? The only way you can really assess it is by seeing what people choose to go into. If, in fact, there are a lot more people trying to get into medical school than qualified people than can get in, then you would say, well, the advantages relative to the burdens of that profession must be higher than the advantages relative to the burdens of other occupations. Otherwise, there wouldn't be that many more people wanting to get into it. So it is the market which is very important here. You want to make sure that no supplier can control the supply so as to keep out competing suppliers. But in fact, since medicine has kept out competing suppliers, you have more qualified applicants to go through medical school these days than are accepted. That's an indication that salaries are going to be too high. You want to drop the salary level to the point where you have only as many qualified applicants as you have qualified slots in medicine. And so again, we need to do some discounting, maybe down from 35 to 25, or maybe to 65, or something like that. But that's the intuitive case for using, theoretically, the idea of a market to be safe. No, it doesn't assume that. It assumes that there are all these different motivating factors, and you want to adjust the salary part of it to the point where the whole package is not so attractive that it creates more, generates more applicants than a position.
When that sampling was drawn, was that sampling drawn on the number of applications in each of different schools, or was it drawn on the number of people that applied to the position? I'm going to apply to a medical or any school. I'm not going to apply to one. I'm going to apply to 10 or 20.
It's already discounted for multiple applications criteria.
The number of people that apply.
But the hooker in it is, who's to say what a qualified applicant is? Medical schools will say they're actually taking unqualified applicants. Now, at that point, I think what we get to is another problem with the whole market orientation. An example will make this clear. Everybody's willing, this has been used by a famous philosopher in a famous book, Robert Noser, who defends the capitalist system. He says, Will Chamberlain, for example, has a very rare talent. Way back. Will Chamberlain puts his talents out on the market, and everybody's willing to fork over an extra 25 cents for the ticket to buy to see the basketball game in order to have Will Chamberlain on their team. And then with that extra money, the team pays Will Chamberlain $500,000 or $1 a year, depending on how many fans are there. And what's wrong with that? It's a free transaction. Well, what is wrong with it, and what's just that author I don't overlook, is that Will Chamberlain has a natural advantage, morally arbitrary and himself morally unjustified. Will Chamberlain has a very rare talent for which there is a very high demand. And whenever you get somebody with a very rare talent, and there's a very high demand for it, that person is going to have a great advantage in the market, which will generate an income for that person, which is morally arbitrary. I call it morally arbitrary because it depends on the sheer accident. The sheer accident of history, biological and anthropological, that Will Chamberlain had this extraordinary talent for basketball, so sports developers, and our society happens to have a taste for basketball games. And what's fair about, to use my own case, so I probably should do that. Philosophers, there seem to be plenty of people around who balance to be philosophers and the desire to be them. The market is weather. And a relatively low demand for those services. And Will Chamberlain getting paid $20,000 a year, Will Chamberlain getting paid $500,000 a year because this talent just happens to be rare and the demand for service just happens to be high. Well, when you get to that, what I think you have to do is just go back to this intuitive principle, equal reward burden ratio of different occupations. That should be the same. But of course, when we ask what that generates in the case of doctors, we don't really know. It's so difficult to assess the rewards and burdens of being a patient. And you get the same terminable argument. You live with this guy. And other people will say, hey, you're forgetting the prestige, too. The argument just goes on. The first thing that... It seems to me that you have to account for some things like that, but at the same time, you don't want to just leave it up to market considerations. You, first of all, to leave it up to the so-called market in medicine.
I really don't think
it just doesn't work because it's not a market.
And you want to be the best you can, and not worry about the industry better than another industry.
Let me just note, and then we'll open it up for discussion. Let me note two other great disadvantages of the perception. The perception, I'm not necessarily talking about the reality, the perception in our society by both physicians and other people, especially by physicians, that they are paid more even after discounting for returns on occupational investment than other people. The two great disadvantages of that are they distance themselves from the pool. That gets into, that's into the whole question of the delivery of healthcare services. So that they don't even deliver the services that are for the poor a good buy, even though they're acceptable. So, furthermore, there's nothing inherent. This is the striking difference between, some extent, between physicians and lawyers. I mean, much more. The striking difference between the high salaries of businessmen and business persons and the high salaries of physicians. In business, making money contributes to the productiveness of the enterprise. The desire to make money fuels, the theory says, fuels beneficially the whole enterprise of business. But does it in medicine? Is there any intrinsic connection between the desire to make money and being a good physician? It doesn't seem to me that there is. You only need an adequate compensation so you get good people in the profession. And furthermore, if you make the physician's income level too high, you get worse people in the profession. If you peg it at the level which would be an equal compensation for the added burden, that's what our focus should be on. But as I said, that's very difficult to do. Okay, end of my
list. Well, I think what troubles me about physician salaries and business is that the paraprofessionals who work with the physician are so poorly paid by comparison. And without the paraprofessionals, the physician could not really do a very good job. And with that, also, with an increase, every time the paraprofessionals get an increase in salary, that is not absorbed by the physician. I mean, they don't take the cut and carry, they don't get it. They're ready to go on, whatever. But that is a principle of all of that. That increase fees. And I have real trouble with that. Well, I'm a paraprofessional. I'm really sorry. Because my salary certainly is nowhere near even the nurse's salary.
There you're not talking about the average physician.
Yeah, that's true. But, I know that pathologists, not only that, they not only get the fees in the hospital, but a lot of them also have affinities in other laboratories in the city, or even in the small towns, medical labs, they're not connected with hospitals. And so
it's in very bad effects on the medical system in general, I think, struggling. The first order of business in looking at physician income is not to lower the average. The first order of business is to take care of one of the particularly more exceptional people. And then the second order of business might be to lower the average somewhat, but to correct for morale problems and imperative perception that the nurses have about their
difficulty.
One thing we talked about is the position of the poor. And I don't know if we've talked about it, maybe we talked about it a second time, but the other problem too is the rural, isn't it? Or isn't that a problem anymore?
Oh, it's very expensive though.
Right, and that's a serious issue of the position of the poor. It seems like urban values may be overdocked, isn't it?
If you're a market economist, you observe the present maldistribution, note that there are distinct shortages of consumers, shortages of business in rural areas, and perhaps even a surplus in urban areas. Not in the right parts of urban areas, perhaps, but certainly in urban areas in general. And then you say, well, obviously the rewards, total rewards compared to the burdens of being a rural physician aren't as great as the total rewards and burdens of being an urban physician. So what we need to do is increase the salary of rural physicians, maybe even 50%, and then we get enough out there. So you then get a government subsidy program or something like that. Now, physicians, organized medicine, have generally been opposed to that because they think if the government trying to push people out of the residence of their choice into some other place of residence. One commentator has just said, has just asked a comparative question. Look at teachers. Look at college professors. Can they choose where they want to practice in the country? No, they have to go where the jobs are, where the demand is. And that doesn't encroach on their freedom of residency or movement. We don't say because you can't get a job in Shaker Heights and have to take one in Tacoma. By comparison, you had your liberty at risk. So why should we say it about physicians if they get enticed by some big subsidy to move to South Dakota? So,
I know some small towns in Minnesota, in a real rural area, that have gone into the medical school and try to find a real poor boy in medical school. Support them and put all kinds of money in medical school. They get 5 years
Only five years.
Yeah, just to get a 5 years, we'll pay you the whole way and better.
Well, it is a problem. I wouldn't want to pin too much on the medical profession for that. It's a problem in other occupations as well. It is going to be a problem in any society like ours that is getting more, that is getting urbanized, and in which people enjoy the educational and cultural advantages in the city.
I think it's
the assumption in our society is that people in a profession want to make money. Secondly, if they're charging less than somebody else, it must be because they can't get as much as somebody else and have questionable qualifications. Now, those just, I think, spill over from other areas of our thinking, the consumer commercial economy, to the rather illegitimately to medicine, because clearly in medicine, there are some people in it who are not in it for the money. And people don't just charge more because they deliver a higher quality product.
But what do you think before in this case? Because if you're poor and you're cooking for the food, maybe you're out of those things, you need to be thinking of taking on a lot of things and nothing. You know what I mean? Would you then, therefore, would you support it if you made that decision? Or would you just go out of business?
If you located your practice, would you practice in the right place?
I think if a man really wanted to do that, he could do it. He'd keep charging his fees and spend the 50 hours, spend 20 down on something else where he was free.
Right, yeah.
He would use that more of him.
Well, I guess this into the whole question of what the financing mechanism should be for providing care to the poor. I would. The worst aspect of the present level of physicians' income is not that it's all that high. It's not that it's relative to me, a professor. It's very high. It's that it's high enough to attract people into medicine with suspicious motives. I think that's the worst aspect. Which gets us away from the fairness. All these discounting businesses items get me away from the complaint, oh, it's not fair that physicians get paid that much and I get paid this. Get me away from that and get us to focus on the other disadvantages of the higher pay.
How do you think that
works? Well, you just have to have quite a different orientation in the profession than in medicine.
What about
the
college?
Psychiatrists are low. Oh yeah. On the average, psychiatrists are
Psychiatrists are something I think about 60
psychiatrists, pediatricians, and pediatricians are the two groups that hold their below, distinctly below the average. And since they're fairly large numbers, such as pediatricians, that doesn't have to be all that low. Pull down to very high, like a $200,000 income, which is rather rare, to a $71,000 average.
I don't think it does.
Probably lower hours. So if a psychiatrist in 58, if you discounted for the low hours, it might be up to
7.
I'm sure. Yeah, you're right.
A lot of these that I first used in the state hospital would be both psychiatrists.
That what?
That like to get people working at a little rate too. So you have to, there's a lot of problems in the
community. A lot of problems.
Even for us, a couple of things I wonder about when people sort of thing. First, the
But there were the physicians that needed them in order to be killed. Very likely to happen in the United States.
regulated capture is a regulator. Whatever captured is. Regulated capture is a regulator. The reasons are very simple. The regulated are the experts.
That's what I understand very well.
And so, of course, over a period of time, the FTC starts out in 1930 or whenever it was founded, when the FDR started out, you know, out to get business. And then over a period of time, it gets gradually regulated by the
Do you think the government is more regulated? I don't know.
It depends on what the political winds are. If the conservative winds continue to blow, and the cost of government-supported medical, mainly just Medicare program alone, you wouldn't have to worry about Medicare. Medicare is enough of a cost problem. We will see if we've got all these other budget cuts, we're certainly going to have some proposals from the Reagan administration about how to control the cost of the Medicare budget. And I can't see the Reagan administration going at all for clamping down high-handed cost control from above. First of all, the studies are very conservative about what that was going to be. I don't think such controls are ever going to work in our society. And it's partly because of the whole cultural background of the medical profession, the way hospitals have grown, and we can't change that overnight. So the only alternative for them is the end-open PA competition model with vouchers, and there's actually a proposal now to the political 2 weeks ago about Secretary of Health and Services and White sort of last line, apparently coming just right now, proposal, consideration of a proposal to change Medicare to a voucher system.
I mean, Tuesday vouchers don't be the best compromise.
The problem is, vouchers are not going to do anything to keep down costs unless you have certain other regulations. You have to change the tax system, I think. Vouchers is just one part of the total strategy. I know, we keep emphasizing the vouchers are only one part of the strategy. You've got to change the tax system. You've got to have this requirement that other employers in society too, not just Medicare recipients where they would have free choice and many options. Other employers in there who are providing any kind of plan at all have to provide a choice of 3 or 4 options. So that the competition created just by Medicare is not going to be enough competition to start driving costs down, and the fee levels paid by Medicare, whether they use a voucher or under the present system, are all going to be dictated by the general pressures in the system. Unless you get equally competitive price decreasing pressures in the other part of the medical, other patients
in the series. In other words, one thing that I think is really bad